Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Monday, April 25th, 2022. The time is 1:33 p.m. We're meeting in State Capitol Room number 205. Senators in attendance today are Senator Keel, Senator Schauer, Senator Hughes, Senator Myers, and myself as Chair, Senator Holland. We do have a quorum to conduct business, and I'll remind members if you have your cell phone, I know I do, and I know mine is not muted. So if you have your cell phone on you, please consider muting your cell phone. But we do have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Nancy, our recording secretary, and Kelsey, our moderator for today. All right, at this point, I will bring Senate Bill 196 before the committee. Senate Bill 196 is related to compelled speech and instructional material transparency in public education. This is the first hearing for Senate Bill 196 in Senate Judiciary. I see Senator Reinbold has joined us today. Would you care to come up to the presenter's table and offer a sponsor statement? Please put yourself on the record and offer your sponsor statement.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and honorable members of the Judiciary Committee. Thank you for having Senate Bill 196 before the committee. I'm Senator Laura Reinbold from District G.
Please proceed.
Thank you. SB 196 is an act relating to transparency and compelled speech in public education. SB 196 is an act relating to transparency, and in section, it matches a lot of Title 14 and Title 18 currently in state statute, in particular relating to the prohibition of against discrimination based on sex, race, in public education. The bill adds a new section of transparency of curriculum and prohibiting compelled speech and enforcement. In regards to the transparency section of the bill, it includes any public school, including charter schools, shall display on the school's website that is regularly updated training material used for teachers, instructional curriculum, and school procedures, title and author materials, and any organizations associated with material, and a brief description of the link to the material to identify where the material was produced. It talks another section talks about prohibitive compelled speech, and we actually did some really good modifications that I'll get into in a little bit in education, and then it goes over in enforcement. But the bottom line of the bill is to try to prevent discriminatory practices that basically if someone is teaching that someone is inherently racist based on the color of their skin. We do not want to use public tax dollars. This is what Florida's Governor DeSantis did a speech recently. It says we just don't want to use tax dollars to teach people to hate our country or hate each other. And so this basically is just trying to eliminate some extremes in education. And as you probably know, this past weekend, there was an article in the Watchman that talked about a district offering staff leadership program this summer that excludes white people from participating. So just things like that. We're trying to be proactive and just ensure that we're not judging and teaching based inherently racism in our schools. And then the transparency part of the bill is just to ensure parents have access to what is being taught. And as you know, with COVID and us being shut down, basically a lot of schools, including the private schools, it's really beneficial for educational materials to be online. So that's in a nutshell.
All right. Thank you, Senator Reinbold. I know you're caught short staffed today. Did you want to walk through the sectional analysis?
I can. Just one second. It's her birthday today, and she just got off a plane. I don't even know if she's in here. Oh, I don't think she's even in here. Okay. So just hold on one second, and I will go through the sectional. It's probably going to make this easier for me to go through the bill. So we are dealing with version D. Is that correct?
Senate Bill 196.
Is it D?
D is in Delta.
Okay, perfect. So that's the Educational Committee substitute. I had both. I had the committee substitute for Judiciary in front of me as well. So in regards to the sectional analysis, basically. Section 1 is amended to replace the words this chapter with affirmative action. Section 2 talks about the Board of regions. It's probably better just to go ahead and go through the bill itself. Affirmative action is in Section 1, and that's the board establishing procedures for affirmative action. Section 2 talks about the implementation, and as I stated, it lines a lot with AS 14.18. Section 3 is, again, at the compliance portion of the bill. Again, it deals with AS 14.18.010. Section 4 is the remedies section of the bill. If a person is aggrieved for the violation of the chapter, these are the procedures that they can use to correct those actions. Section 5 is the effect, and basically it says it's a supplementary to add and does not supersede existing laws relating to unlawful discrimination based on sex or race. Section 6 deals with the transparency and compelled speech in education, and this one gives very specific things such as training materials used for teachers and other staff on training non-discrimination, diversity, equity, inclusion, race, ethnicity, sex, bias, or other concepts that includes one or more of those concepts. And this is basically what we did in this section, which I thought was some good changes, is what they can do and also how it should be updated. There were some time frames on how long that the information needed to be remained posted. In Section 14.18.160, this is the prohibiting compelled speech. This was actually changed in education. This is, I think, a good change where it doesn't say what the teacher cannot do in Section 1. It's what they can do, because we wanted to make sure in education that it wasn't discouraged, you know, people getting involved in civics. And then in Section 2, it's what they may not do. And this is where, for examples, I'll give you a few examples. It said that it says they may not direct, compel a student, teacher, or administrator or other employee to infer, adopt, or adhere to a belief or a concept, for example, that the United States is fundamentally or irredeemably racist or sexist, be an individual by virtue of sex, race, ethnicity, religion, color, national origins, is consciously or unconsciously inherently racist or oppressive or sexist. So it gives the what you cannot do. There's some parameters in regards to that. And then on page 5, section 14.18.170, this is the enforcement, and so how the policy will be enforced. And then in the final section, 14.18.190, is definitions of public schools, school district, state agency, etc. So that's a very high level.
All right. Thank you, Senator Reinbold. At this point, you've invited Mr. David Boyle as invited testimony. And I believe we've confirmed he's out there. So, Mr. Boyle, if you can hear me, please state your name, your affiliation, and your location for the record, and begin your invited testimony.
Thank you. Chairman Holland, committee members, I'm David Boyle. I'm testifying for myself and thousands of parents and students. I want to thank you for this opportunity to comment in support of Senate Bill 196. I believe this is perhaps one of the most important bills, second only to Senate Bill 39, in this legislative session, because it will determine the futures of our children and our state. I have provided testimony before, as you know, to the Senate Education Committee on the various parts of this bill. I will provide that testimony to this committee in writing. Because this is the Judiciary Committee, I'll provide testimony regarding the note from Legislative Legal, which is in the documents and basis for this bill. The first issue Legs Legal deals with is teacher speech in K-12 public schools. Note that Legs Legal did not address the curriculum transparency portion of this bill. At issue is the compelled speech portion of this bill. Legs Legal states that this raises a First Amendment concern because the bill, quote, prohibits a public school from teaching certain concepts, end quote. However, Legs Legal then says that in the case Garcetti versus Savalos, the Supreme Court of the U.S. established a rule that, quote, this First Amendment protection does not apply if an employee is speaking in the performance of their duties, end quote. Teachers are speaking as government employees, so they do not have First Amendment protection in the classroom. When public employees make statements pursuant to their official duties, they're not speaking as private citizens for First Amendment purposes, and they can be disciplined as such. I disagree with the statement by Legs Legal that, quote, however, the court left open the question of whether this holding applied to speech relating to scholarship or teaching, end quote. The court clearly stated that public employees, that is teachers, do not have protected First Amendment rights when they are in the teaching environment. Wedge Legal further clouds the issue on First Amendment rights when it discusses the Deemers versus Austin case heard in the Ninth Circuit. This court applied a five-step process to determine whether an employee's First Amendment rights were violated. Number one, did the person speak on a matter of public concern? And number two, whether the person spoke as a private citizen or a public employee. It is clear that teachers are public employees when in the classroom. So Ledge Legal concludes that, quote, a professor's teaching and academic writing may be protected under the First Amendment, end quote. Note, Ledge Legal's conclusion only refers to professors, not K-12 teachers, and there is a distinct difference in the First Amendment rights. This Ninth Circuit court only applied to universities and professors, not the K-12 teachers. Then Ledge Legal goes on to say that, quote, it is possible that the Ninth Circuit court would find that the teaching and academic writing of a K-12 public school teacher is protected under the First Amendment if it meets the test established in Pickering versus the Board of Education, end quote. But Pickering only addressed a professor's academic speech, not a K-12 teacher. Ledge Legal's comment is thus merely conjecture. The Pickering case involved a teacher who wrote a letter to the editor regarding a school's budget. He was acting in his personal capacity, not official capacity as a classroom teacher. So the Pickering case is also non-applicable here. The best part is, Ledge Legal finally concludes that it is, quote, it is therefore also likely that Senate Bill 196, speech prohibition that's applied to a K-12 public school teacher, would survive a First Amendment challenge. Let's take a look at the second part of Ledge Legal's discussion. This has to do with a student's First Amendment rights. The U.S. Supreme Court decided in Board of Education versus PICO that the school board, which I find interesting, did not have the right to remove books from the school library. It said the right to read and receive ideas is also free speech. But the issue here is not the removal of curriculum materials. The real issue in this part of the bill is that the school and teacher or teacher cannot, quote, require a student to participate in student activism, lobbying, or efforts to persuade the executive or legislative branch at any government level, end quote, and be rewarded with a course grade, extra credit, or credit. By the way, this is what occurred when former Governor Bill Walker presented his lesson plan to Anchorage students on his budget. He wanted the students to do a survey of their friends, parents, and neighbors by push-polling his budget. Then these students were to provide the survey results on the former governor's blog, and they were given credit for this. This is what this part of Senate Bill 196 would prevent, as it should. The final part of Ledge Legal's note referred to vagueness, which I find rather vague in and of itself. I believe that Senate Bill 196 lays out those subjects very clearly that are referred to Ledge Legal's discussion of vagueness. As a matter of fact, Section 14.18.162, A through F, clearly lists those areas that are prohibited as compelled speech. And one of them is the U.S. is fundamentally or irredeemably racist or sexist. And you can see the rest of them in there, A through F, on page 4 of the bill. This does not prevent a student from contacting the legislature, lobbying, or supporting a policy candidate on their own, not at the direction of the teacher. Finally, remember that the First Amendment and all the Bill of Rights to the U.S. Constitution were written to protect citizens from the government, not give power to the federal government. I want to thank you for your time, and please pass this very important bill to the Rules Committee, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Boyle. At this time, I'll look to the committee, see if they have any questions for the sponsor or the invited testimony. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two for the sponsor, one for Mr. Boyle. Thank you. I know I was going to say Doyle. So, David, just by way of the testimony there, could you provide any background? I don't remember if you were a lawyer or teacher or other things, and I only ask it just because sometimes it helps as we're debating it, to know how you get your point of view from what study or what experience.
Mr. Boyle?
Well, through the chair, Senator Schauer. I actually was a communications officer in the Air Force for 20 years, and then I became the most important job, Mr. Mom, for many years, and I helped found the Alaska Policy Forum in 2009, and I volunteered for 9 years as with the Policy Forum, and 5 of those years I was the executive director.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chief, for the sponsor.
And with no other questions, committee, proceed to the sponsor's questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two, I'll just ask them in order, but I'll just do the second one so you don't have to go back to it. Because I don't know, Senator Ramble, can the school districts already do this on their own? This is more of a top-level policy. If they weren't doing it, this would compel them to. Do they have authority to do this already? I guess is what I'm asking. I don't know.
My understanding is we're supposed to be teaching what is non-discriminatory, you know, if we're following Title 14 and 18 right now. So I would think that they wouldn't be able to do, but the bottom line is it's creeping up all over, and I've got examples all around me of things that I'm willing to discuss before the committee, because denying that they're doing it isn't helpful. We actually have to face reality of what really is going on in the classroom. So I'm not sure if that exactly answers your question or not, because I'm not on the front line. All as I can do is take, you know, testimony from what people are saying is going on. And if I didn't answer your question, if you could be a little more specific.
Senator Schauer, were you more interested in if the school was interested in posting their transparency?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
If you're interested, if the school wanted to,
they could put the restrictions. Without this, and I probably asked it wrong, without this bill, could a school district decide to do everything that the bill is directing already on their own without the state saying you had to or could?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, thank you. That I definitely didn't hear that in the question the first time, so thank you for the clarification. Yes, I believe that they could. Because of COVID, a lot of them were having to do everything by Zoom anyway and posting the curriculum online, and that's when a lot of the parents actually became aware of what really was being taught in the classroom. So, yes, I believe that they not only – have the authority, but I believe they have the ability as well.
Thank you. And
second question.
Thank you. Other states, I know other states are doing things like this. There's sweeping movements across the country on COVID and mandates and school and all kinds of things. Do you have a list, and you certainly get it to the committee later if you don't now, of other states that are doing this, and then as they're doing it, are there any current or past court cases that you're aware of that provide us kind of some guidance on how the courts have viewed these so far? If you're aware of any, thank you.
Okay,
Senator Reinbold?
Through the chair, I will probably not best thing to do, but my staff is, it's her birthday today, so I'm giving her a light day. And she just got off an airplane. She's got that information. I believe that there's 3 states that have enacted, and I believe Florida is one of them. And they went extremely bold in regards to this, in even stronger language than what we have in Florida. So did that answer your question in complete? I will get back with you on and the court cases. I wrote it down and I believe 3 states have, and it could be more. I think that there's an introduction in a lot of states in regards to it, and I haven't followed the status of all of it this session so far.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was curious if there's any court cases that could help us just as we wade through it and take a look at it. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Senator Reinbold, I'm looking at page 5 near the bottom there where we're talking about the enforcement, excuse me, and you're saying the Attorney General may commence a civil action in Superior Court to enjoin, et cetera. I'm curious, just thinking about the powers of the Attorney General in general, no pun intended, if this is something that they do regularly, do they, is it already within their purview to file civil suits against the school district or other municipal body on a regular basis anyway, or is this something new that we're asking the Attorney General and Department of Law to do?
Hey, Senator Myers.
That's actually a very good question, and I would actually need legal to get on to be able to answer that question. We just wanted to make sure that there was – when you ask somebody to do something – and then you don't give anybody authority to do something about it to make a difference. That's what we were trying to do here, to make sure that there was an enforcement mechanism at this time. What to be honest with you, I'm not 100% sure at this time if they're allowed to do it or not. We just wanted to ensure that they were given an opportunity to do it and to hold districts accountable that were violating, so that there was a mechanism to make a difference.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up on that. Why'd you pick the Attorney General rather than leaving it up to parents groups, other groups within the within a community that probably know a little bit more about what's going on?
Through the chair.
Senator Reinbold.
Because we read what the duties of the Attorney General are, and he's supposed to, you know, be somebody that all Alaskans can turn to, and he's got a lot of resources at his disposal. And I can tell you, even with this COVID stuff, it is extremely hard, you know, to have be able to raise money. Lawyers are extraordinarily expensive, and so we wanted a government entity to be able to make a difference rather than depend on the, you know, maybe a parent who has been negatively impacted by something that was, you know, a student, their student was negatively impacted. We wanted to ensure that they had an agency to turn to be able to advocate on their behalf.
Thanks, Senator Myers. Senator Hughes.
So the Attorney General would, it sounds like the Attorney General would want to do this. So let's just take a moment. Maybe the Attorney General doesn't agree with the parents bringing something forward, so the Attorney General decides not to do it. There's nothing in this that would prevent that parent or community member taking it to court themselves. Is that correct?
Senator Reinbold?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hughes, that is correct. You legally, I mean, you can take people to court, in my opinion, for so many reasons. I actually think there needs to be a triage. Because I think there's a lot of frivolous things in the courts right now, why a lot of the really big things are not getting addressed. So the answer is yes, they could.
Follow up, Senator Hughes?
Not.
I thought you had gotten your answer.
No, I actually don't have a follow up on that. So I have other questions, but we can move on to someone else and come back.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that point, I mean, to the concern of the issues that Senator Myers and Hughes raised, I guess the question would be to the sponsor. I assume that this discussion of the cost of lawsuits and the difficulty of all this is the reason for putting in the Attorney General's opinion section. My assumption would be that you put that in place to avoid the need for lawsuits when political subdivisions of the state get an opinion from the state's top of the heap attorney. But I'll invite if the sponsor can confirm or deny that's sort of part of the purpose of that AG opinion section.
Senator Reinbold?
Well, like I said before, we just wanted to ensure that some people had somebody to turn to in the state government, and that we wanted to direct them to a specific agency or person that had authority to look into something such as this. And I think that answers your question. Okay.
Senator Keel?
Oh, when you're ready for other topics, I'll get back in line.
Senator Hughes.
And actually, I thought I was ready for another topic, but based on that, now I'm reading on page 5, line 28. So the only ones that can request the AG's advisory opinion, it appears, is a state agency, school district, governing body, charter school, or public school. So what if they don't request and the parents have concern? Can the parents request that of an AG, or can they not if we don't give them statutory authority to?
Senator Reinbold?
Maybe, Mr. Chairman, maybe that's a good amendment. I mean, that's exactly why we bring things to committees, such as judiciary. So I would highly recommend an amendment there. I think it's a really good point.
All right, I also believe we'll probably have to have Ledge Legal on for some of the points that have been brought up today. But Mr. King, care to grab the Alaska statute and read something to us?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Ed King, staff to Senator Hollins. Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to state for the record that we did make a request both to the Attorney General's office and to Legislative Legal, both of which were preoccupied with mostly the budget today and were unable to attend. However, I would point to the existing law within Title 14, Chapter 18, and the enforcement mechanism that currently exists for that chapter. And that's in 1418.090 is the is the enforcement mechanism, and that is an appeal to the State Board of Education to enforce the through regulations and to enforce the chapter. And then if a person is aggrieved, that's 1418.100 under existing law under remedies. And an aggrieved person by a violation of the chapter, regulation, or procedure adopted by this chapter as a primary or secondary education may file a complaint to the board. That's the parent's opportunity to go straight to the Board of Education and file a complaint. Moving these duties to the Attorney General is a departure from current law. And if the committee wanted to be consistent with other enforcement for education statutes, the State Board of Education would be that vehicle. That can be accomplished by simply removing the, I believe it's one of the earlier sections that limits the range of applicability to continue to apply to the entire chapter.
All right. Thank you, Mr. King. Is there any follow-up questions on this topic? Nope.
Different topic.
Different topic? Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm looking at a couple of sections of the bill, and I'm getting a little bit of conflicting messages here. I'm trying to figure out where we're trying to go. Page 4, lines about 23 and following, may not use public funds to contract with, engage a speaker, consultant, trainer, to encourage students, teachers, administrators, etc., to adhere to a specific belief. But then we go to page 5, and line 15, it says that you can voluntarily have these things so long as you're not requiring attendance or participation by either a student or a teacher or other school employee. And so I'm getting a little conflicted there. On the one hand, it says you can't do it. On the other hand, it says you can. So what's the intent here?
Senator Reinbold?
I think I know where you're going with this, but I didn't write down exactly the page that, at the first half of the question.
So it's page 4, starting line 23 through roughly 27.
23 versus?
On page 5, line 15.
Okay, so just so everybody can do the best they can to follow us, on page 4, it's what may not direct or compel. So that is using public funds to contract, hire, or otherwise engage a speaker, consultant, diversity trainer, or other person to adopt a specific belief or concept. So that's what it's addressing on page 4. On page 5, we continue down, and this basically says may not require a student or teacher to administrator to employ to attend, participate, training, seminar, continuing education, orientation, or therapy that promotes a concept described in Section 2. And then it says, does not prohibit speech protected by the Constitution, voluntary, uninduced, uncoerced attendance or participation. So they can voluntarily go to things. It just cannot be forced.
Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess maybe what's throwing me off is on page four, line 25, it starts out with the word encourage, which, I mean, you have a speaker, they're there to encourage something. Maybe just for clarity's sake, we pull that word encourage out, because it's looking to me like you can, if the point here is you can have, let's say, a seminar on a Saturday morning or on a Wednesday after school is out, and you know, people are welcome to come, but it seems like you can't encourage. If you're saying they can't encourage anything, then page 5, line 15 there wouldn't apply at all.
I'll join in real quick, because we have the benefit of seeing this and Senate Education. And I think on page four, line 25, when you talk about encourage, direct, or otherwise compel a student to affirm, adopt, or adhere to a specific belief or concept, there's a big discussion on you can encourage them to reach out to a political organization or entity and espouse their beliefs, but you can't encourage them to take a specific side on a belief. But I'll let the senator the sponsor answer her own question.
I think you did a really good job, and I think you have a point in regards to the word encourage, because it's not found anywhere else, the direct and otherwise compel. However, if you read the rest of the sentence, it's telling them that they cannot compel a student, teacher, administrator to affirm, adopt, or adhere to a specific belief or concept in that very narrow in section two. So it's a very, very, very specific things that they're not allowed to do. However, in regards to the first page, the second page on page five, it totally is different. It's the voluntary, uninduced, or uncoerced attendance is allowable. So we wanted, in education, what we were doing is changing it instead of an absolute prohibition. They changed the whole bill, so what you may and may not do. And that's where, so this is a new version that I just saw today for the first time with a new concept. I believe it was Senator Hughes's amendment, and that's how things changed between the mays and may nots.
Senator Hughes?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, the page four is required, page five is optional, but actually I think I know why the word encourage is stuck in there on page four with direct and compel, because once a school staff encourages something, they're implying that it's a good thing, and that's going to have influence, right? So we're not even allowing on page five encouraging optional things. We're just letting students know, hey, there's going to be a speaker, there's going to be a seminar, there's something in the auditorium. You have a choice. You can go watch that in the speaker in the auditorium, or you go to study hall. So it's not allowing influence one way or the other. So even though encouraging isn't force, it is casting an opinion that students can be very much influenced by an adult. So if a teacher is saying, you know, I think this is really good, you ought to go to it. You don't have to, but I think it's really good. That puts influence in. And if it's on one of these items that we're talking about in this bill, as far as the sex, race, ethnicity, all of that, and the teacher is encouraging people to go, that's going to, and kids will do things, you know, especially if they're super motivated, they want to be on that teacher's good side, they could actually attend something that really should be optional. So I kind of see your point, but I kind of like the word encourage in there, because adults shouldn't be influencing kids on things that can have, different positions on it. They're basically influencing them to go after one position, even though they're not forcing them. Does that make sense? And it maybe could be worded better, but I can see why it was included. And you're smiling, so maybe you have another thought, but
working on it.
All right. Thanks, Senator Hughes. Senator Keel.
To that point, Mr. Chairman, it's an interesting, I think, acknowledgement of the role that school officials and teachers can play. There's actually a case I think the U.S. Supreme Court is considering today about whether they can lead prayer, specifically for precisely the reasons that Senator Hughes brought up, is just how influential those teachers are, whether that's an establishment of religion. But I guess that word encourage also sort of struck me, Mr. Chairman. And I guess my question is, to a great extent, I don't think it's possible to understand the history of the 20th century if you haven't read Marx and Engels. Don't have to buy a word of it, but you better understand it if you hope to grasp what went on. And so I guess I wondered about encourage and about some of the other language in the bill, affirm, adopt, adhere to a belief or concept. Is that why when we look in section two, and this question goes to the sponsor, or I guess sub two in 160, that list of the things that are suspect under the bill. We talk about sex, race, ethnicity, religion, but we don't mention class. Do we exclude class there specifically so that schools are free to teach communism?
I'm sorry, say that last part again.
Schools do we exclude class so that schools are specifically free to teach communism?
Okay. communism. Thank you. Senator Reinbold.
I'm really not sure where he's going with this, but I want to address the first part in regards to the encourage, the word encourage, because that's, you guys all keep going that. When it, on that section three, it says may not use public funds to contract, hire, or otherwise engage or speaker, consultant, the diversity trainer, or other person. So it's basically hiring someone to encourage. So you got to make sure you read things in context. And so that's why I think it's okay the way that it's written as it stands right now. And to divert over back to this, I excluded class. I'm sorry, what are you talking about? Like economic class, or what are you talking about in regards to why did I exclude something, or why did the bill exclude something?
I believe what the senator was saying was amongst the items that you have there, diversity, equity, inclusion, race, ethnicity, sex bias, or another concept. I guess you mean economic class.
Economic or social, yes.
Or social class. And were you intentionally leaving the door open to instruct in communism?
Okay, well, the bottom line is I don't think that this bill technically addresses that, you know, one way or another. But I think communism is a form of government. So I believe that they can teach about that. They can teach about in capitalism, et cetera. I mean, that's a type of government. But if you want, I'm trying to understand, are you recommending an amendment? So, yeah, this bill is strictly in regards to the Constitution, what the Constitution, you know, so basically this is what they may not direct or otherwise compel. So basically force a student or teacher, administrator, or other employee to affirm, to adopt, or to adhere to the belief or concept that, one, the United States or the state is fundamentally or irredeemably racist or sexist. B, an individual by virtue of their sex, race, ethnicity, religion, color, or national origin is consciously or unconsciously inherently racist, sexist, or oppressive. C, an individual by virtue of race, sex, ethnicity, religion, color, or national origin is blameworthy for actions committed in the past by other members of the same sex, race, ethnicity, religion. D, an individual's moral character is necessarily determined whole or in part by the sex, race, ethnicity, religion, color, or national origin. E, a sex, race, ethnicity, religion, color, or national origin is inherently superior or inferiority. And F, an individual should be adversely treated based on sex, race, ethnicity, religion, color, or national origin. This is a non-discrimination bill, and that's why I think it's absolutely critical to keep the discrimination, not bias, in the bill. And so basically this is an anti-discrimination, and so you can't force someone to be discriminatory based, you know, with compelling them to adopt or adhere a belief or a concept. And I think this is what we want in America. We don't want to teach kids to hate each other based on their color of their skin, or that because of the color of their skin, they're inherently one way or another. And that's, it's a very simple, clear definition that I think the vast majority of Americans could agree with. So let's not color outside the lines. Let's deal with it with what the bill actually does.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on that, a question about 2A, the notion that one of the prohibited things would be that the United States or the state is fundamentally or irredeemably racist or sexist. I know what irredeemably means. But in this context, I'm not sure I understand what fundamentally means. The U.S. Constitution had at its origin, America's fundamental law, had at its origin explicit protections for chattel slavery, which was black slavery. So is teaching that fact of history in violation of this law if it were to pass?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Reinbold.
They absolutely can teach about the Civil War and things like that, and things that were excluded or included in the Constitution. That is not what this is about. This is not directing or otherwise compelling a student or a teacher or an administrator or other employee to affirm, adopt, or adhere to a belief or concept that the United States in general is fundamentally, irredeemably racist or sexist. So teaching about the Holocaust or teaching about Civil War and stuff, absolutely. That's saying right here, the United States or the state is fundamentally or irredeemably racist or sexist. You cannot force someone to believe that is what it's saying.
So then the practical application question, if I may.
Follow up, Senator Keel.
So the practical application question would be if a school may teach that the fundamental original law of the United States had racist pieces in it, is it not compelling the student when you ask that question on a test? And if not, what does fundamental mean here?
Senator Keel, I think you're confusing the thought of the United States is fundamentally racist versus it had maybe, portions of fundamental racism in it, as opposed to the United States. And I will let the senator answer it, but I just worry about us picking the arguments here, picking the fights. But the statement is the United States or the state is fundamentally racist or sexist, versus whether some of the fundamental origins of the United States was racist or sexist. But Senator Reinbold, do you care to offer some input on that?
Well, first of all, thank you, Mr. Chairman. There has been slavery and racism in many countries, and it still exists in some places in the world today. But the bottom line is, it's very clear that you just can't teach people to hate the United States and teach each other to hate one another strictly based on sex, race, ethnicity, religion, color, or national origin, or is consciously or unconsciously inherently racist, sexist, or oppressive. I can also flip the question around and say, you can talk about the people who hated slavery so much in this country that they were willing to die to prevent racism. And I think that's an angle that needs to be taught. How many people have lost their lives in the past during the Civil War because they hated racism so much? And I certainly don't want that. When I was talking to my mother, I'm going to get a little casual right now, this weekend, she was so thankful to me, my 93-year-old mother, that I was bringing this issue up because she said she hated discrimination as a child and she never wanted it to rear its ugly head again. And that's exactly why this bill is coming. There are some pretty egregious examples of what's going on in books and curriculum and training sessions. And Anchorage Movie Night is a direct challenge to critical race theory, you know, agenda, different courses, different training opportunities. It's creeping in, and it we're just trying to nip it right now. So we've come so far as a country, and let's not forget how far we've come. It's amazing how far we've come. Let's keep on a more positive path to try to unite us and not divide us based on irrational things. It's just, there isn't, people are not, I mean, the United States is not fundamentally or irredeemably racist or sexist. And an individual by virtue of their sex, race, ethnicity, religion, color, national origin, consciously or unconsciously, or is inherently racist, sexist, or oppressive, to teach that, I think it's just horrific. We just are trying to prevent some horrific concepts that are creeping in our schools from taking root because they can impact our children and our generations in the future, cause tremendous problems. And that's all we're trying to do is prevent some pretty hateful concepts being taught in our schools.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold. Senator Hughes.
Yeah, this might be helpful. I was in the prior committee of referral to Senator Keel in that we were looking at this language and we wanted to make sure, like the sponsor wants to make sure that things like the Holocaust, like the Civil War, like Martin Luther King Jr. could be taught in the schools. And so we didn't know if we needed any clarifying language to ensure that those kind of class discussions and instruction could occur. And Led Legal indicated in reviewing this that they did not see anything in this section that would prevent that type of instruction. So, civics education, those kind of things are not being prohibited at all by this section. So I thought that might be helpful. The other thing, which isn't really particular to the point, it's more why I'm supporting the bill, and it is on basis, and I encourage people in the audience and people at home listening and members at this table to look up a flyer that's on basis with this bill, that in the month of December, there was a course at UAA, and it was being marketed to Anchorage School District educators. If they came to a one-day workshop, they would receive a stipend of $3,000, a stipend of $200 in addition for books, and it was entitled The Anti-Racist Writing Workshop, How to Decolonize the Creative Classroom. So we have heard in the past that, for instance, critical race theory is just an academic theory that is taught at the university level. But indeed, we are seeing this the creep into the K-12 system. And so the students, as we talked earlier, they can be pretty influenced. And I think parents are concerned about that. And that's the genesis of this bill, is parental concern and parental rights. And having students exposed, particularly at the high school level, to begin to sharpen their critical thinking skills as far as things, some of these matters, is important, but their minds must be left open and free to make their decisions and draw their conclusions and not be a force to affirm, adopt, or adhere to a particular position on these things. So I do think this bill is important at this time. I also read an article, I believe it was late last week, that there was some review of curriculum in Florida. These were math books for, and I'm not sure what grade, I think it was grade school, math books, and an overwhelming percentage of math books had elements that would not be allowed under this bill, where they were trying to influence the children on some of these things. There was quite a large percentage. So I just think it's important for this body, Mr. Chair, to really consider this. What do we want, and what kind of curriculum do we want in our schools? I think the transparency piece in this bill is excellent. I'm kind of surprised we don't have something like that already, but there's never a better time than now to get something like that set. And I think that transparency piece itself will really help, ensure that some of the stuff doesn't creep in. But it is out there, and there are occurrences of already happening in the classroom.
All right. Thank you, Senator Hughes. Senator Schauer.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Since we kind of dove into the philosophical side, a couple comments as this is going back and forth. But, you know, one of the things we have to be very cognizant of is parents' rights. Who has the right to teach your children? Is it the state? Is it the teachers' union? Or is it the government? Or is it the parents? And fundamentally, if we're going to talk fundamental, that should be the right of the parent. It's not the right of a teacher to teach something that you disagree with as a parent necessarily, depending on the topic and how this plays out and what the courts have ruled upon. So first of all, we should be looking at this, at least in one sense, of what is the most responsible person to the education of that child and what they are exposed to, and that is the parent. That's not necessarily the teacher. That's certainly not the school, the principal, or a union association, et cetera. The parents are the ones with the most vested interests and, quite frankly, the highest rights or the most rights. And fundamentally, Mr. Chairman, when we're talking that word here at the top here in line 7 in sub-bullet A, fundamentally means basically that's your foundation. Essentially, it never changes. Things are built upon that. The country was built on fundamental precepts, but nowhere in there, and if you read the Founding Fathers, because I know some here have, they talked at length about many of them were slave owners, but they didn't like it, and they foresaw that this would change with time. If you go back to the Three-Fifths Law, it's one of the things where a black man or woman, a black person in America, was not a whole person. Their concern goes to the South and the kind of power it would have had at the time to prevent the Union from forming, et cetera. There's a lot behind it. But I guess my point of this is that today, Mr. Chairman, racism is institutionally illegal in this country. You can't do it. Not legally. And we've crossed that barrier. People are racist, but you can't change somebody's heart with legislation. We've made it as illegal as we can make it, and we're trying to change hearts and minds through education, social constructs, you know, as the culture hopefully advances. But the most fundamental word to me that matters in this bill is on line 8, irredeemably. This country is not irredeemably racist. It's not irredeemably bad. It is a self-correcting experiment, which I think is the point of this bill. is to say people have done bad things all over the world. As Senator Ramble said, racism, Mr. Chairman, has been all over the world, still exists today. We were just seeing bills in here about human trafficking and basically human slavery today. In this state, no less. We know it's here in a different way. But it's not irredeemable. And if you look at the founders' intent, Mr. Chairman, and go back and read what they wrote and listen to, well, listen to their, can't listen to what they said except their words, it was a very different environment. And I think to have a charge that this country is irredeemably racist is not what we should be teaching the next generation. That divides us further, and a house divided itself against itself cannot stand. We are a self-correcting experiment. We are getting better with time, and I hope that we will continue to. But I hope that that will draw the line between the word fundamentally or irredeemably racist, because to me, those are the fundamental parts of this that do matter. Sorry for the diatribe, Mr. Chairman. We're diving down that and now we're getting off on that topic, but that's very touchy to me from my background. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Schauer. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I once again find myself agreeing with Senator Schauer. America is not an irredeemably racist country, and I don't know any irredeemable people. The bill uses or, not and, irredeemably, fundamentally or. And so when I, in the absence of a definition in the bill, when I looked up fundamental in the dictionary here, it is an essential part of, a foundation or basis, not the entirety of. So it would seem to strike exactly at the description you gave, Mr. Chairman, of being one thing the country was founded on, even if not the entirety of the foundation today. I'm glad that Senator Hughes raised the flyer that was in the packet, because I was confused looking at the flyer and reading the bill. The flyer is for a course offered by the university. It is not taught to students. It does not give any impression that it is required attendance for teachers, counselors, district contractors. And so if the flyer is the target, I wonder, how does the bill stop? How does the bill cancel, I guess is the word we're looking for, this kind of workshop?
Can I answer that? I'll let Senator Hughes answer, and if she doesn't do a good job, I'll offer my thoughts on that point as well. But Senator Hughes.
Welcome as well. First of all, the university space was used. They didn't offer it. As we looked into it, turns out that it was some money from the municipality of Anchorage that was from the prior administration. In fact, Sean Parnell, who has the UAA campus, was not aware that the space was being used. My point was not that this bill would stop that course from being offered. My point was that this thinking is infiltrating into our schools. In July of 2021, NEA, their national convention, there was a lot of discussion and training on this topic and encouraging teachers who are members of the NEA to get to incorporate these kind of teachings in the classroom. So the point of the flyer is that this topic is not reserved just to the university arena, that it is infiltrated into our K-12 system.
Thank you. My thoughts would be that the flyer is pointed to our K-12 teachers, and that I had to look up the definition of colonize and figure out what decolonize meant, and I did have concerns in reading that flyer in that there is a concern that there is to decolonize to instruct teachers to teach in a certain fashion. And this bill doesn't address that. This bill addresses what, trying to ensure that our students are taught fairly and impartially. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I guess I would say I share Senator Schauer's concern then. You've got a flyer for a training aimed at changing hearts and minds, aimed at making sure that our teachers are not using racist methods or racism in the classrooms. And the bill seems aimed at stopping that great correction from happening. Boy, that worries me.
I will add that I don't believe this bill is aimed at that training in particular. But with that being said, I think we've exhausted questions on this. We do have another bill we want to hear today. Senator Reinbold, do you have any closing comments today as a sponsor?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to point out, if you're going to do amendments, I would highly recommend doing the Florida one where it says sets curriculum standards that ensures curriculum and teacher professional development align with required instruction and state standards, including no critical race theory or Common Core. So anybody who knows me know I fought Common Core for about 5 years, and this is the kind of crud that has snuck in through cracked doors with the Common Core. And I would like to point out in the Watchman article this weekend, the Anchorage School District is offering a staff leadership program this summer that excludes white people from participating. It's open to teachers, counselors, nurses. Minority leadership program aims to empower staff of color to ascend through the ranks of leadership within the Anchorage School District. In order to participate in the program, employees must be staff of color. These are just the kind of things. Are we going to go back to discriminating based on the color of our skin or national origin, or are we going to try to prevent some of the things that have happened in the past and that we have corrected and come such a long way? This bill unifies. This bill stands on our Constitution and upholds what we took an oath to, our constitutional rights, and it aligns with what is already in state statute, Title 14 and 18, and that's why I do believe version D is going to be a far better version than version N. With that, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to be here, and it's a worthy topic.
All right. Thank you, Senator Reinbold. At this time, I'm going to submit an amendment deadline for 5 p.m. on Thursday, April 28th. And at this time, I will set Senate Bill 196 aside. Thank you, Senator Reinbold. Next up is a brief at ease. All right, thank you. Senate Education's back on the record. At this point, I'll bring House Bill 246 before the committee. This is the first hearing on House Bill 246 and Senate Judiciary. I see Representative Christ Tompkins is here. If you care to come to the presenter's table and bring any staff that you care to bring up with you. House Bill 246 is relating to accessing marijuana conviction records. This is the companion bill to 207, which we've already heard twice in this committee. And Representative Christ Tompkins, do you care to offer your sponsor statement?
Sure. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Jonathan Christ Tompkins, representative for a bunch of Southeast Alaska communities. And House Bill 246 is familiar subject matter to the committee already, at least in part. And I think just in the interest of a sort of brevity, won't sort of recover what the committee has already covered.
Can you mostly address maybe some differences between 246, House Bill 246, and Senate Bill 207?
Absolutely. I think we're going the exact same direction. And the major substantive difference between the two pieces of legislation is an amendment that was added in the House Finance Committee. And this relates to underage possession of marijuana for 18 to 20-year-olds. So not minors, but 18, 19, and 20-year-olds, because, of course, the legal age of marijuana is 21. And presently, if you're 18, 19, or 20, and you get caught with pot, it's a Class B misdemeanor, which is punishable by up to 90 days in jail and a fine of up to $2,000. And the amendment in the House Finance Committee changed the underage possession of marijuana for 18 to 20-year-olds to be a violation, effectively mirroring what happens if you're 18, 19, or 20 and get caught with alcohol. So sort of mirroring the severity of sanction between the two. And that's the basic gist of it that was added in House Finance. I guess the one other thing I would add is that there was an intent language amendment made to the Senate Bill 207, and that corresponding intent language has not been changed in the House bill. And just as sponsor, I'd say that's small potatoes and happy to go, you know, wherever the committee wishes to go there, whether it's the Senate version or the House version.
All right. Are there questions for the sponsor? Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a few, although others are always free to interject. So I'll start off with, I'm looking at page 3 of the bill, looking at starting line 27 there, section B. It says a violation of this section must be charged and filed with the court as a separate case. It may not be combined with or joined with any other minor offense or criminal charge in one action at the time of filing. What is the point of that section? Why are we specifically charging it as a separate case?
Senator Myers, through the chair, and I can speak to this, and Ms. Gross or Ms. Mead with the court system can also speak to it or correct any misstatements I make. But that's called a joinder limit, and the same thing exists with alcohol, underage alcohol violations. And I'm going to make my best attempt, and Ms. Gross or Ms. Mead can correct me if I get wrong, but the court view system, effectively, for it to be able to not present certain records, it needs them disambiguated, separate, not joined together as one. And so the joinder limit effectively makes that possible, so that if you are 19, you get caught with a joint or whatever, you get charged with, you know, a violation, that if you're doing a bunch of other bad stuff while you have that violation, like, I don't know, reckless driving or vandalizing something or whatever, you got charged with a bunch of other things, that if they're all bundled together, my understanding, and again, Ms. Gross and Smee can speak to this, is that for the court system to, they kind of need to remove all of it or none of it. And there's not any in between technologically with their database. And so it's important to sort of separate out the violation for underage possession so it can be treated on its own within court view. And that's also true, of course, with underage possession of alcohol or underage consumption of alcohol. But I'm going to ask.
Ms. Gross, would you put yourself on the record?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Holland. For the record, Claire Gross, staff to Representative Christ Tompkins. And to add to what he just said, I'd just like to add a couple things, and that is that when you look at the rest of this bill, both SB 207 and HB 246, the main meat of it in the beginning, and both of them and still, was the 21 years and older. And we had the stipulations for the very narrow type of convictions that we were dealing with. And remember, we had it listed in both sections 4 and section, I believe now it's section 7. One of the stipulations is that you must not have been convicted of any other criminal charges in that case. So we're already dealing with that same software limitations on court view with the 21 years and up. We're just looking at those cases retroactively. But because we're creating a new violation, they have to, at the time that that's being charged, set it up in a way that it can be taken off of court view like we have asked the court to do with this bill. So we're looking, it's just sort of the difference between after the fact, before the fact, and something that has been of concern to people when they hear that you're charging a case as a separate case. I just want to say that we've spoken with the Department of Law, and when you get a violation, it is almost entirely an officer, I can't remember what the exact word is, but it's like officer adjudicated ticket, or where an officer of the law, a police officer, will issue these and deal with them. And it really doesn't go any farther than that. A prosecutor will rarely ever get involved in any way. So we have also been assured that, and the violations that were created by the minor consuming changes for people under 21 are still being issued. We're hearing that they're able to do this by charging it as a separate case, even when there are other charges in that case. So we've been assured by Department of Law that this should not create a disincentive for officers to still charge these violations. It's really not a big deal for them, and they can do it easily, just format-wise. At the time of charging, if there are a bunch of other charges, they can just, it's the nitty-gritty of how they file them, essentially. And, I mean, it could even be helpful if you think of it, if there are a bunch of other charges together that are not violations and are going to have to be prosecuted and will require, you know, court time and whatnot, to have these separated and clean. That is my added editorial, but I sort of see it that way. And we have been assured that this does not, they don't see this as creating a disincentive to still apply these charges if someone were to get caught with them.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Gross. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Christ Tompkins, is it then your goal at some point, either with this bill or with a future bill, then to be able to direct the court to pull the minor convictions from court view as well? Because that sounds like that's the point of the joiner prohibition is later on we'll be able to pull those. Is that your goal?
Senator Myers, through the chair, no, it's not. I'm wondering if we're getting a little muddled, or I may have added some muddledness to the conversation. So I think first off, you were asking a question on page 3, and I hadn't gotten there when you asked the question. I think I assumed that you were asking about the joinder limit. What was the language on page 3?
So it's page 3. Line 27.
Okay.
So that subsection B there. A violation of this section must be charged and filed with the court as a separate case. It may not be combined or joined with any other minor offense or criminal charge in one action at the time of filing. So that's what one of the things that we went over when we had the Senate version of the bill before us a couple of weeks ago. We talked about how the court system could only take things from court view if it had just that charge, not if you had a conviction for marijuana and shoplifting or something along those lines. And I can understand that from their point of view and from an administrative perspective, but it sounds like you're trying to make it, with that language there, you're trying to make it easier for somebody to then pull the minor use of marijuana charges later on because now you've already split it out so that you can pull those from court view as well.
Senator Myers, through the chair, that's not the intent. But I'll ask Ms. Mead to come forward and speak to this.
I say if you want to swap out Ms. Mead. Please put yourself on the record and offer an insight on the point under discussion right now.
Thank you for the record. This is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. Through the chair to Senator Meyer, I'm not certain that I understand exactly what your question is asking. I would make clear that in this version of the bill, those cases for misconduct involving marijuana for the 18 through 20-year-olds will not appear on court view. So I'm if that helps clarify the question with respect to what might happen in the future, and that provision is on page 4, lines 20 through 22. That addresses this new offense created by section 5 on page 3 of young people, not under 18 and not over 21, this interim age group. That's a brand new offense, and this bill would provide that those do not appear on court view, and that's why it has to be a separate, its own thing, or else the court would need to remove an entire case, even if it was, you know, murder and possession of marijuana, which I don't think is the legislature's intent.
Thank you, Ms. Mead. I appreciate that. So that does answer my question in the affirmative, then, that the point of that subsection on page 3 then is to allow the court to not post those pieces to court view then. So I appreciate that.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think just something that may help clarify going forward is just being very careful about the use of the word minor. So this bill, minors technically relate to 18 and under, and this bill does not relate to them. This relates to the sort of no man's land of 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. So we're not touching anything with 18 and under possession of marijuana in the bill, nor do we intend to. And I just sort of want to flag that.
Well, Ms. Mead, while we have you here at the presenter's table, do you have anything to offer from the Alaska courts on House Bill 246?
To the chair, I'm happy to answer any questions. We're neutral on the bill. This is something we can accomplish. We can identify those cases for misconduct with marijuana by 18, 19, and 20 years of age. And if the legislature tells us to, we can no longer post those on court view, which is what this would call for if they are charged separately. And that is the way we deal with alcohol. And we're grateful for the extended effective date because these will need a new type of case number and whatnot so that we can make that an automatic process going forward.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Mead. So, Senator Keel, you had your you had a notice up for a little bit of your concerns been resolved?
Mr. Chairman, I was going to flag what was clarified by another speaker. I guess I did have a question for the sponsor or for his office, because there may be an unintended glitch in the drafting with regard to the levels of offense for using or displaying more than, let me see if I've got this right. I think it's more than an ounce.
Page 3, line 26, less than 1 ounce of marijuana. You're looking somewhere else.
I think, Mr. Chairman, if I'm reading this right, and I may need to spend a little time on this, but it actually looks like if you're knowingly using or displaying more than an ounce, for juveniles, actual juveniles, of course, that doesn't change. It's a B misdemeanor now, B misdemeanor with a bill. And for anyone 21 plus, more than an ounce would be that B misdemeanor. But I think that would be only a violation for our 18, 19, 20s. And I'm not sure that discrepancy was part of the goal. But I just wanted to check and see whether there was a desire to actually lower that one or whether that's something that we could tidy up.
Ms. Gross?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. Yeah, I spoke with your office a little bit about this briefly on Friday, and we thank you for identifying what looks to be a drafting mistake in this. And you're referring to where it says here on page 3, lines 24 or 25 and 26, where it says misconduct, person age 18, 19, 20 years of age commits the offense of minor misconduct involving marijuana if the person knowingly uses or displays any amount of marijuana or possesses less than 1 ounce of marijuana. And that's not our intention. We wanted it to just be dealing, because that's basically saying if someone uses or displays 3 ounces of marijuana, we're still shielding them or making it a violation. And so that was a drafting mistake that we're happy that you caught, and we would be absolutely open to an amendment on that. And we've talked about some possible easy fixes, but I think removing that language for the most part and just sticking to possession of less than 1 ounce of marijuana, which we specify in the other sections of the bill as being the only part of AS 1171-060 that we are dealing with. So that would make it match up like we want it to with what we're doing for with the scope of convictions that we're using for 21 and above as well. So yes, that's correct.
Thank you, Ms. Gross. Thank you, Senator Keel, for catching that. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I got a question from Ms. Mead. Since the last time we had the other bill up in conversations outside of committee, it's come to my understanding, which I didn't know before, that apparently there are some other offenses that are blocked from court view as well. Is that correct? And I was curious as to what they were.
Through the chair to Senator Meyer, the other ones in statute that are violations that are not posted on court view are minor in possession or control of alcohol, commonly called minor consuming, even though that's not what it's called, and minor on unlicensed premises, which is a minor going to use alcohol on an unlicensed premise. So they are both alcohol related. There are also three, those are statutory. There are three statutes cited in our court rule that that we do not post on court view, and that they're in Title 28. They're minor driving after receiving a minor consuming ticket. This is not DUI. It's unrelated to the minor consuming ticket, but there's a statute that says a minor may not drive for a certain time period after getting that cite. We do not post those on court view, but again, that's under court rule. And there are two other traffic-related ones that are similar.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Senator Myers. Thank you, Ms. Mead. Senator Schauer.
Mr. Chair, while Nancy, you're here, or for Jonathan, or for staff, I guess, just depending, because there were some changes as this came through the House that we haven't had a chance to talk about it yet, compared to the Senate version of the bill, and trying to make sure I read this more for the record, we were discussing this as a way to strike this from the record for those that had this before the bill passed that made it legal, the initiative. Is there anything that's changed that through the House now that as we continue on that people would get these as I read it now and have them stripped out as opposed to kind of the original kind of thought process, which was to clear out those that had the convictions previously? So I'm talking now and future, as you know, that would get a charge as opposed to those that had them, but they were simply trying to clear them so that moving forward they could get back to work, you know, get jobs, et cetera. If anybody could answer that. And if Ms. Mead, if you think there's anything that applies, I'd appreciate that too. Thank you.
I'll take a shot through the chair to Senator Schauer. The intent of this bill, as you say, is to take those over 21 that you had them, and theoretically nobody over 21 should be getting them. I'm just talking about possession of under an ounce, and to take those off of court view and to shield them from certain criminal history records checks by DPS. That, of course, remains in the bill. This bill does not touch, again, as Representative Christ Tompkins said, anybody under 18. That will still be a misdemeanor to possess an ounce of marijuana. And those 18, 19, or 20, which today is a B misdemeanor to possess under an ounce, will be lowered. The penalty will be lowered to a violation where they get a ticket. It'll be on a bail schedule so that they do not need to come to court. And those going forward will not be posted on court view. So that's different. So now adults, it's okay. 18 to 20s, it's a violation, not on court view. And 18 and unders, it's a B misdemeanor, not on court view because of other reasons. That is, it's a crime and therefore handled by Division of Juvenile Justice. That helps.
And to add to that, through
Ms.
the chair.
Gross.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, Senator Schauer. I want to be clear that the violation, making a misdemeanor violation, will not happen retroactively. So neither the becoming from a misdemeanor to a violation or the removal from court view will only happen going forward the way that the bill is currently written for 18, 19, and 20-year-olds.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Gross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there any other questions or comments for the sponsor or for Ms. Mead? Thank you. I will invite Kelly Howell to the presenter's table if she has any comments from DPS on House Bill 246. Please place yourself on the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Kelly Howell, Special Assistant to the Commissioner and Legislative Liaison for the Department of Public Safety. The Department of Public Safety does support the changes in this bill and what the bill does in terms of ensuring that those that are encountering difficulties in obtaining housing or employment due to these convictions for the activity that's currently legal don't incur those challenges in the future.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Howell. Any questions for DPS? Seeing none, I'm going to invite Mr. Representative Christ Hopkins back to the table. If you have any final comments on your HB 246 before we wrap it up.
No, just appreciate the committee's attention and also the vice chair's work, especially on the parts that have been common to both versions. I would maybe just add that the amendment that was added in House Finance, it really sort of came up because of a sort of going down a rabbit hole and comparing how marijuana and alcohol was related through committee dialogue and then some conversation that happened after, and sort of realized that this was a big asymmetry between how alcohol and marijuana were treated. And so there was that sort of inspired the Finance Committee's amendment. But I mean, I think it all feels, at least my perception of what the intent of the initiative was, to sort of treat alcohol and marijuana similarly in a regulatory and legal manner. Just a little bit of context there. But.
All right. Thank you, Representative Christ-Hopkins. At this point, I will set an amendment deadline also at 5 p.m. on Thursday, April 28th for House Bill 246. And is there any other business before the committee? Seeing none, our next meeting is Wednesday, April 27th at 1:30 p.m. And today we will be adjourned at 2:55 p.m.